Good afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. About a week from today, Alaska voters face a couple of important decisions. One is about selecting a governor. Another is deciding on Ballot Measure 1, also called the Salmon Initiative. This initiative is highly contested with strong support on both sides. The goal of this show is to unpack this initiative for voters. We have a representative from each side to discuss pros and cons of the initiative in what we hope is a neutral environment aimed at sharing facts. What do we know? What is speculation? What still needs to be resolved should the initiative pass? Today's show is pre-recorded to accommodate scheduling challenges, so we won't be taking calls. You can still email us at hometown@alaskapublic.org, and after the show, we'll try to work. If you've got questions, we'll try to work and get you some answers. So now let's get right to it. I'd like to welcome our guests. We have Emily Anderson, who is an attorney and the Alaska Program Director for Wild Salmon Center, speaking for Stand for Salmon. Welcome, Emily.
Thank you.
Really happy to have you. And Clint Campion is also an attorney, and he's here today speaking for Stand for Alaska.
Hello.
Which is a no vote on the initiative. Stand for Salmon is a yes vote on the initiative. Stand for Alaska is a no vote on the initiative. Just to put that out there. Before we get started, we have useful links on our website at alaskapublic.org, including the initiative language, the state of Alaska's FAQ on the initiative, and links to other interview or forum programs in public media that are aimed at helping voters evaluate Ballot Measure 1. And we've included the website for each side, as well as Ballotpedia's analysis of the measure. So you've got your homework before you go to vote next week. So let's get started. I expect this format, Hometown Alaska, very conversational. It's not a debate. I expect that we'll go back and forth and pick apart pieces of the ballot measure and give each side plenty of time to contribute what they want to this discussion. And we won't be taking calls, so that gives us a little more time to just focus on the initiative. I'm going to start out with just a really broad question to each of you. Tell me, and I'll start with Emily because you're a proponent for this initiative. What is the ballot measure about? What does it call for? In just simple terms, just, you know, warming us up. Tell us about it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm going to put away the legalese today, I promise. You know, the ballot measure is an effort driven by thousands and thousands of Alaskans across the state. What we've seen over time is that there have been projects proposed that communities around the state are very concerned about in the state of Alaska. And what we know about our current law that is designed to protect fish habitat is that it's 60 years old and hasn't been updated since statehood. Now, the intention behind the law is very, very good, but from a legal standpoint, it's extremely general. So the ballot initiative is essentially designed to infuse some science into an outdated law and to make sure that when we are doing projects and proposing projects in and around salmon habitat and projects that could harm salmon habitat, that we're doing so in the most responsible way and making sure that this is a science-driven process rather than a political process.
Okay. So, Clint, I'm going to come to you, speaking for Stand for Alaska. From your group's perspective, what is this initiative about?
So this is, from our perspective, a very complex, detailed law, a series of subsections in the law that would completely overhaul the Department of Fish and Game's responsibility and authority regarding not just salmon habitat, but nearly every waterway in the state of Alaska. It is, as I've said, complex, and we are concerned about the cost to Alaskans, both in the potential loss of jobs, the potential increase in costs associated with implementing it through both the Department of Fish and Game and other state departments. And our primary concern is that the timing, we have grave concerns about the initiative itself, but the timing in particular at this point with where our economy is today and where it has been in the last number of years is particularly concerning.
Okay. I'd like to ask Emily if you've got a question for Clint based on what you heard, and we'll ask you, Clint, also to ask Emily a question. But what, based on that, what would you respond or ask?
Well, I think that we are, all Alaskans are very concerned about the economy. I mean, that's certainly from the salmon side of things and other industries in the state of Alaska. But I think the biggest thing here and the biggest takeaway is that the salmon industry and the fishing industry in general brings in a lot of money to the state. It is the salmon industry in general is a $2 billion economy for the state of Alaska and supports thousands and thousands of jobs, 32,500 jobs in, to be specific. The tourism industry also has a ton of jobs in the state of Alaska, 43,000 jobs it supports in a $4.8 billion economy. I think we're short-sighted to suggest that simply because we're putting habitat protections in place that we are somehow harming our economy. There are a lot of folks that, you know, really care about the salmon economy, and I guess that's my question is, how is putting habitat protections in place, these are common sense standards, you know, essentially harming the entire economy of the state of Alaska? That seems a little far-fetched.
So my response would be that there can be little doubt that the initiative, if passed, would create additional processes, additional permitting processes, and would make it more difficult. There are there is the potential that major projects just won't be able to get permitted if the initiative passes. And whether that is true or false, it certainly will signal to companies that want to do business and develop natural resources in Alaska that it's going to be more difficult to develop those projects, to get them permitted, and to get investment in those projects. And that's not the message that we want to send. I can't tell you today that if passed, the initiative would result in the loss of a certain number of jobs. But from our perspective, we think we can have both a healthy salmon habitats as they have been, as they are today, which would include a healthy salmon industry, a healthy fishing industry, a healthy tourism industry, and continued growth in the development of natural resources.
Okay. And Clint, do you have a question for Emily based on her opening explanation of it?
Sure.
Of the initiative.
My question would be, how would you respond to concerns that were raised by various state agencies regarding the cost of implementing the ballot measure if passed?
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. You know, when state agencies in the state of Alaska actually look at the fiscal costs associated with a ballot initiative, unlike a bill that's going through the legislature, they only have to look at the costs. They don't get a chance to look at, or they don't have the requirement to actually look at cost savings through the state and also potential revenues coming in through a different or change in law and a permitting process. Right now, I mean, the state agency that we're looking at is Fish and Game. Fish and Game is estimating that the cost, and again, this is only the cost associated with the project or the proposal, will amount to about $1.3 million per year over 5 years. A lot of those costs are associated with updating our really, really outdated public notice system. The Department of Natural Resources has an online public notice system. The Department of Environmental Conservation has an online public notice system. Fish and Game doesn't have one at all because there's no notice requirement, period. The other cost savings that the state doesn't necessarily have to look at when they're looking at costs is the fact that with the anadromous waters presumption that the ballot initiative creates, this is a common sense reason to make sure that Fish and Game has the jurisdiction to protect anadromous fish habitat. And that, again, is the type of fish that swims out to the ocean and spends part of their lives in freshwater and then part of their lives in the ocean. And those are the fish that we're talking about, like salmon. If Fish and Game doesn't have to spend all the money going out and surveying every single river, lake, and stream in the state of Alaska, which is hugely expensive, and instead can assert their jurisdiction to essentially be able to protect fish habitat the way they need to, then that's a huge cost savings for the state. And finally, Fish and Game has never charged any sort of money for a permit, ever. DEC does, DNR does, to help offset the costs of the permitting process. Now, for small projects, that means maybe a novel permit requirement or a cost of $25 just to help offset the cost. But for large industrial scale projects, this allows the Department of Fish and Game to shift the cost to the big industry rather than having the state foot the bill.
Okay. I'm sure we could go back and forth some more on that, but let's move on a little bit. We're going to go to the actual elements of the initiative, but before we do that, I've heard from both sides, you know, we've had a great process for 60 years. It's great. We've got thriving industry, salmon industry, fishing industry and tourism, and it's been working well for 60 years. On the other side, you know, I hear that it's outdated and it doesn't have what we need. So that's what I want to talk about, that 60-year window, and talk about if it has worked well, or what's missing. And just as part of this, well, I won't go into that. I'll just leave it at that. And maybe I'll start with you, Clint. Basically, Stanford Alaska said, hey, we've got a premier protection of our salmon. We're known around the world for it.
So I appreciate the opportunity. I think what I would like to start with, I think it's important for your listeners to understand what the current law is and understand where it would be headed to if the measure passes. There is an anadromous fish act that has existed under state law. That's the 60-year-old law that the advocates for the initiative have mentioned. And it is not as broad as the initiative would require, but it does permit the commissioner of the Department of Fish and Game to specify rivers, lakes, streams, or parts of them that are important to the spawning, rearing, or migration of anadromous fish. So that's the current law. And there is a catalog that the Department of Fish and Game has developed, and it develops over time. And it requires that Fish and Game go out and survey certain waterways if they're believed to be containing anadromous fish. But ultimately, the Department of Fish and Game will and shall permit projects so long as the proposed construction work or other use of the waterways, so long as they will sufficiently protect fish and game. And so that's the current law. And from our perspective, there are not projects that have been permitted by Fish and Game in the last 20 to 25 years that have undermined the salmon habitat or anadromous fish habitat across the state. And so really the current system is working and has protected fish habitat, and it's allowed the biologists at the Department of Fish and Game to apply their own backgrounds in science to ensure the protection of the salmon habitat.
Okay. On the other side, Stand for Salmon, there's a great call for change. Tell me why.
Well, as Clint mentioned, the law is extremely general. A commissioner shall issue a permit unless the plans and specifications are insufficient for the proper protection of fish and game. There is no definition of what the proper protection of fish and game is under the law. It's not in statute. It's not in regulations. We don't find it anywhere. And so from a legal standpoint, what that means is that we have a very, very general standard. And that general standard is applied differently across administrations. So you may have an administration in office that is very protective of fish habitat and our fisheries. You might have another administration that is extremely pro-mining and pro-development and sees fish as an impediment to development. And that's a problem. And so what we're trying to do is make sure that the law is applied fairly across industries and across the state and across administrations. And so we're taking the politics out of those decisions and instead making sure that these are science-based decisions, which they should be. As you mentioned, Clint, you know, the Department of Fish and Game should have the ability to use their biological background and their input in biology and the sciences to make these sound decisions. But when politics gets involved, oftentimes that overrides that really small, sound decision-making from the department.
Mm-hmm. All right. Talking about science brings up my next question, because I've been reading all the commentaries in the paper, and they do, both sides rely on science and bring up science. And to me, an average citizen, not a scientist, I'm a little confused. So I want to read to you, you know, from one commentary that mentions science, and then it's just a short, very short, and then another one that mentions science, and then I want to talk about it. So this one was in yesterday's paper, and it cited two directors of habitat for the Division of Fish and Game, past, retired. I think it's Randy Bates and Kerry Howard. And there were some other people who signed on to this. But this is the sentence that interests me. Ballot Measure 1 replaces Alaska's scientific process for identifying, studying, and permitting fish habitat with new and untested regulations. So there's that science word in there. There's another commentary I read in the paper. This one is another former director of the Habitat Division, Frank Rue, and this was in July of this year, and his sentence is this: the initiative puts clear science-based salmon habitat standards in statute and provides for a robust public process when resource development decisions that could have significant negative impacts on salmon habitat are made. So both sides are claiming science. So for your average citizen, help me understand that. I'm happy to start with you, Clint.
Sure. The problem with the way that the initiative is written is that the advocates for the initiative have decided what the science will be without any public input. There has not been a robust public discussion about those standards. And so you've just described two sides of the same the coin. You've got people that have similar backgrounds who are saying that science has been in place, and the other side is saying that they're not. The problem with this initiative is this has not gone through the normal legislative process. It adopts standards that would be forced upon the Department of Fish and Game without any input from the Department of Fish and Game. This is not like a normal legislative process where Fish and Game can come and provide testimony about what they believe are appropriate scientific standards or not. The advocates for the initiative and the drafters of the initiative have decided what those scientific standards are.
Okay. We're going to go back to you, Emily, from Stanford Salmon. Science-based decision-making is part of the initiative. Tell us why it's coming up like that.
Sure. Well, I think the first thing to do is think about where this is rooted, where this science-based decision-making process is rooted. The idea that the initiative was drafted without any public input is just completely false.
And we can talk about that.
Right. Yeah. But it goes back to the Board of Fish. The Board of Fish actually looked at a proposal that was basically asking the Board of Fish to say, hey, you know, should this law be updated? Does it have the types of standards in place that will actually protect fish habitat over the long term? And the Board of Fish looked at that proposal and said, absolutely not, and wrote a letter to the legislature. One of the reasons for that is that the Board of Fish developed in the past a sustainable salmon policy, which actually outlined standards that are very similar to the standards that you see in the initiative. The problem with that regulation is that it's unenforceable. Right now, it's a discretionary regulation that the Board of Fish developed. But a lot of that great science and that science understanding and that knowledge comes from the sustainable salmon policy and was basically infused in the ballot initiative. This ballot initiative and also HB 199 that went through the legislature, a lot of scientists were actually weighing in on that and saying, hey, these are the standards that we need to be looking at. These are the habitat characteristics that we need to be careful of in order to maintain the sustainability of our fisheries long term. So that's where that science comes from. These are not scientific standards that came out of nowhere. These are very well-known standards that biologists apply all the time. And these are things that the ballot initiative basically infuses into the law to make sure it's a science-based process.
Okay. I just want to remind listeners, if they're tuning in, they're hearing lots of talk about science. This is Hometown Alaska. We are talking about ballot measure one, which voters in Alaska will decide on November 6th. And we have a representative from Stand for Salmon, Emily Anderson, and we have a representative from Stand for Alaska, which is No on the Initiative, and that is Clint Campion. So we were just talking about the fact that both sides are resting on science and the need for science, and I just had them explain a little bit more about that. I think now it might be a good idea to begin to unpack the initiative, what's actually in it. This is an 8-page initiative, and it's a bit formidable, I think. And I guess to Emily's point that she was making, HB 199 was an attempt to go through the legislature. It does feel like many people feel that that would have been a better process, but it never went anywhere. So I guess the Alaska State Constitution allows citizens to at least do this, to try to get things into law. So let's talk about what is actually in the initiative. I asked you earlier for your sort of broad perspective, but now we're sort of going to get into the nitty-gritty, and we may go back and forth a lot on that. Who would like to begin? I'm open. Since you're with the initiative, Emily, maybe it's smart for you to start.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk a little bit about it. You know, when I talk about the initiative, we think about it conceptually in terms of what are the broad concepts that the initiative is basically trying to infuse into our law, to update our law. There's a lot of legalese in the initiative. That's something that we can't get around. It becomes law if it actually passes. If the citizens of Alaska vote on it, just like if the legislature passes a bill, it becomes a law. And that's why you see some legalese in it. The reason why it's 8 pages long, essentially, is because we have very little foundation to build on. When you're building a house, you don't build something up from a shaky foundation. You make sure you establish a strong foundation, and then you put in the building blocks to make sure that it operates and that the house stays upright. And so that's essentially what the initiative is doing. That's why it's 8 pages long. But when we break it down into just general terms, what it's trying to do, first, it creates habitat protection standards. These are standards that provide guidelines for the Department of Fish and Game when issuing a permit. This allows it to be a science-based process, and it takes it out of that political process realm. You have to follow these guidelines before issuing a permit. The second thing it does is it creates an anadromous waters presumption. That essentially expands Fish and Game's ability to protect anadromous fish habitat, rather than having to go out and prove that the water that they know has anadromous fish in it supports anadromous fish. They shouldn't have to make spend the money to make that assumption, essentially. So this would reverse that course and make sure that Fish and Game can use the law to protect fish habitat when issuing a permit appropriately. Third thing it does, and this is probably the most important thing, is that it creates a public process. For the first time, Alaskans are going to be able to weigh in on important decisions, on especially projects that have the potential to damage fish habitat. And that is something that doesn't exist under the current law. There's no public notice, and there's no opportunity to participate. Alaskans deserve to have a voice in the permitting process.
Okay. I was signaling to Emily because I need to take a break. You're listening to Hometown Alaska, and I'm Kathleen McCoy, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and it's election season, and our topic today is ballot measure one. We have representatives from each side, sort of those who have put up the initiative and are supporting it, Stand for Salmon, and the folks who are asking you to vote no for this, Stand for Alaska. So we have Emily Anderson here on Stand for Salmon, and we have Clint Campion here from Stand for Alaska. And I had just asked Emily to kind of roll out what the specifics of the initiative are, and she just laid out three of them. And I want to go to Clint and give him an opportunity to comment on those. Do you see them the same way? Do you have nuance here you want to talk about?
I do. So I'd like to start first. We've been talking about science, and that's where Emily started, that the initiative would create habitat protection standards that would rely upon science and not politics. And my personal experience with the biologists at the Department of Fish and Game comes from my involvement in a prosecution of a miner in the Mat-Su Valley in 2012 who altered a salmon-bearing creek, and I ended up involved as a prosecutor prosecuting him criminally for that. I didn't have any prior experience with Department of Fish and Game biologists, but I did in that matter, and that went on for a period of time in 2012. And what struck me then, and I think is still true, is that those biologists are not politicians. They are not guided by political considerations. They have studied and trained to become biologists because they care about science, they care about our salmon habitat. And it's offensive, frankly, to think that the biologists that work at the Department of Fish and Game are motivated by politics. The folks that I worked with in that case that helped protect and hold someone accountable for altering a salmon stream were guided by science, not politics. Secondly, the initiative creates a presumption that that would create a presumption that all waterways are anadromous fish habitats. This is one of my primary concerns about the initiative. As I said earlier, the current law basically only covers streams, lakes, and waterways that are known to have anadromous fish. The initiative essentially covers any waterway, and you can read the initiative for yourself, but it includes all sloughs, backwaters, portions of a floodplain covered by the mean annual flood, adjacent riparian areas that contribute directly or indirectly to the spawning, rearing, migration, or overwintering of anadromous fish. That's a mouthful. The point there is that while Emily and those that are advocating for the initiative say it's difficult for Fish and Game and expensive for them to prove that there are anadromous fish in a waterway, this initiative would put the onus on everyday Alaskans to prove a negative, to prove that a waterway, which may be a dry creek bed in August, that that Alaskan that would want to use that waterway for some project or some use would have to prove that there are not and have never been anadromous fish in that habitat. That's a very difficult and expensive proposition for Alaskans, whether they be individuals or industry. And to suggest that there has been no public process is not realistic. Any project of any size of any importance in the state of Alaska has to obtain a great number of permits from both state and federal agencies, and most, if not all, of those permits do require a public process. So any of the major projects that you might think of affecting salmon habitat already have a requirement for public notice.
Okay. Any comeback to that, Emily?
Yeah, definitely. First of all, I think, you know, we want to talk a little bit about the public process. Essentially, relying on the federal government to drive a public process.
Would that be EPA or?
Sure. A lot of these major projects require federal permits. A lot of times it triggers NEPA, the NEPA process. The NEPA process is merely procedural. It doesn't have any substance in it. It's basically saying, making sure that we're checking all of our boxes, we're looking at the environment, you know, we're reviewing the environmental potential of environmental impacts, and we're making sure that the public gets to weigh into those decisions. But I always think about it in terms of, well, these are state assets. Fish, wildlife, and water are state assets. They're reserved in the Alaska Constitution to the people of Alaska for common use. Shouldn't our state agencies be the ones that are listening to the public, listening to the public's concern, making sure that these decisions are being made with the public in mind? I am not suggesting at all that the people of Fish and Game, unlike what Clint just mentioned, are doing anything wrong. I'm talking about the legal deficiencies in the law. And when we do have large development projects with lots of money backing behind it, are we suggesting that Fish and Game has the ability to say no to these permits? Under our current law, I think they'd be hard-pressed to say no about these permits. That's what I'm talking about with respect to the political pressure. When you're thinking about all that money, all that potential money coming into the state, there is a problem there. If you don't have a science-based law to help Fish and Game to stand up and make those decisions and defend those decisions, and that's what I'm talking about. I'm not suggesting that the Department of Fish and Game or the people, the good people that work there, are, you know, politically motivated by any means. And then finally, there has been a lot of confusion and a lot of misinformation about the presumption of anadromy. First of all, it does not apply to every single water body in the state of Alaska. It's applies to water bodies that are connected to salmon habitat. And we know that those connected waters are the ones that support fish, and they support those salmon. Salmon have to migrate. A lot of times those upper reaches of those water bodies are not currently listed in the anadromous waters catalog. That's where baby salmon live. That's where baby salmon are being reared. If we hurt those upper reaches of those water bodies because this law doesn't get triggered under the current law, that's a problem for our sustainability of our salmon long term.
Mm-hmm. I think we should talk just a little bit about the catalog, because it sounds like, what are we talking about? The Sears and Roebuck catalog? What is this catalog? How did rivers or waterways or bodies of water get into the catalog in the first place? And it's kind of open to either one of you to talk about that.
My understanding is there's roughly 20,000 waterways that are in the catalog now, and it grows over time. There's a fairly straightforward process. It's my understanding that most of the time, Department of Fish and Game gets involved directly, in many cases or many instances, initiate the process. But any member of the public has the right to notify Fish and Game that they believe that a waterway contains anadromous fish, and then that process can start. And there are some considerations that the Department of Fish and Game needs to consider. So that grows over time, and that is a public process.
Okay. And Emily, input on that?
Well, actually, it's a science-based process, and it's folks, whether it's the Department of Fish and Game, if they have the money to do it, go out and sample a stream, or it oftentimes falls on tribal interests or the public to go out and spend the money to sample every mile of every river, lake, and stream that we believe has anadromous fish in it, just to get it protected under the law. A perfect example is when the Pebble deposit was discovered out in Bristol Bay. Many of the river systems around, in and around the Pebble deposit, were not in the anadromous waters catalog. That meant that Fish and Game was not allowed to actually require a fish habitat permit for exploration projects in that area. What happened functionally is that the Department of Fish and Game went out there, spent over $500,000. The tribes in the area spent a lot of money trying to sample those river systems, and so did private citizens and entities were trying to sample it, rushing out there to try to get those streams listed in the catalog, even though we knew that they are safe harbors for salmon.
So is there a shift of burden to a developer to show that there is no salmon in a river versus, I mean, help me with that. I do feel like if Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologists are going out there, that is state money that is figuring out whether our waters are in the catalog. But I did read that a developer, the burden would be on the developer to prove that there are no fish. So help me with this. This is confusing.
That's not how the
ballot. I have it wrong.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's something that's been talked about a lot, and there's some misinformation about that actual process. This is a rebuttable presumption of anadromy. Most often, a developer will go out into an area, and many, many of our rivers, lakes, and streams that are connected to the ocean support anadromous fish. They can make the choice whether or not they want to challenge that presumption or not. That is the only time a developer would actually have to create or go ahead and sample the water, ask a fish and game to come out and actually create some, do a scientific study and sample the area. If not, they simply apply for a permit. That's how it works. You don't have to prove a negative unless you want to essentially say, hey, the presumption of anadromy should not apply here. Mm-hmm. That's the only time.
Mm-hmm. Clint, any additional thoughts on that from Stanford, Alaska?
This highlights a broad concern that I have about this, that if there's a dispute, if there's a disagreement about who has the burden and whether or not the waterway is connected to an anadromous fish habitat or not, in the absence of any legislative history or any further legislative discussion about this, these issues are going to have to be resolved in court. And that is, a primary and a broad concern that I have, that the uncertainty in the language and the initiative requires our court system to get involved to interpret what they mean, and that's going to take time, it's going to take money, and as I've said from the beginning, I'm concerned that as we're going through that process, it's going to cause economic harm to the state at a time that we can't afford any economic harm.
The interesting thing about that argument is simply that, you know, when I talk to the oil and gas industry, for instance, or the mining industry, the claim is, hey, we go out and we do all of these scientific studies in the area. We make sure that we are not impacting the environment and we are searching for fish. If that's the case, then why is there a burden or uncertainty placed by essentially saying, hey, we're going to presume there's fish unless you can tell us that there isn't? So that's the thing. I mean, it's kind of like a double-edged sword here, and I don't know exactly why that argument is being made from the other side, because essentially it doesn't make any sense. If they claim that they're already doing those studies and then they're making sure that they know where anadromous fish are and where they're not, then how is that going to slow down the economy? Essentially, mm-hmm. We're just making sure that it's in statute, that that requirement is in statute.
Mm-hmm. Clint, anything come back on that? Or you've said your piece, right?
No, we could go back and forth, but I just want to make sure it's clear that this is not just about industry, the oil and gas industry or the mining industry. This has an impact on regular Alaskans that may own property or may wish to use property that may or may not involve an anadromous fish habitat. And there's a risk that if they don't obtain a permit or they don't challenge the presumption, they are running a risk of both civil and even, frankly, criminal liability if they're incorrect in their assumption.
Okay, and this sort of brings up the two-tier process. My sense is that from what I read, that there's a major and a minor designation, and that let's talk about that and how that might affect the concern that Clint has raised. Emily, tell us about the two-tier permitting process and whether that resolves some of these concerns, or Clint, whether it does not.
Sure. The tier two process, or the two-track permitting process, was designed specifically to ensure that everyday Alaskans are not heavily burdened by this new permitting scheme. Now, keep in mind that the only time a permit is required is if you are using, obstructing, diverting, or polluting an anadromous fish stream. That does not mean that every activity that you are basically, you know, doing around fish habitat requires a permit. The other thing is, not every place that we have in Alaska is actually an anadromous fish habitat, and that's the only time a permit requirement is triggered. The other misperception here is that simply because you need a permit, that this is somehow going to be a huge burden on everyday Alaskans. Right now, under the current law, for instance, you need a permit to put a dock in, a personal dock in an anadromous fish habitat. It's a very, very simple process. You apply for your permit. Fish and Game just says, hey, they put some conditions and stipulations in the permit. They say, make sure you're being careful about this, and please don't put your dock on spawning areas. That's essentially what they do for that. The ballot initiative does the exact same thing through the minor permit process, allowing everyday Alaskans that are already required under the current law to get a permit to continue to have that same easy process under the proposed initiative. The major permits will be the ones that have a different process, and that makes sure that we have public notice, an opportunity for Alaskans to voice their concerns with these projects or to support these projects too, and also to make sure that Fish and Game is properly scrutinizing that project and publicly scrutinizing that project so we know what that project entails. That's the major permit process.
I'm going to come to Clint, but I just have one question. I think I read that there will be public notice on minor permits. There will be public notice and public comment periods on major.
That's correct. Yeah, public notice is basically just the ballot initiative requires that electronic public notice is issued for every permit that is authorized by Fish and Game, but that doesn't mean that you have a public process that's associated with it. It just means that we should be putting a geolocated dot on every permit in the state of Alaska and how they're doing. And the Department of Natural Resources and also the Department of Environmental Conservation has a very similar public notice system.
Okay. Clint, any thoughts about that?
Sure. I'll start with the major versus minor. Emily and I may not be able to resolve our disagreement about this, but if the presumption is that all waterways are anadromous fish habitat, then if an everyday Alaskan wants to put a dock in a waterway, they have to assume that it's an anadromous fish habitat, or they have to challenge it. And if either way, there's either some risk that they could be wrong if they assume that if they challenge it, there's a cost associated with that. They'd bear that burden. And if they decide, well, I don't think it's an anadromous fish habitat, they do run some risk that they could be in violation of this law if it were to pass. So there is an increased burden on everyday Alaskans that is in excess of what the current burden is. But I think Emily makes a good point when she says there is a current process to protect anadromous fish habitat. The process today is, if I want to build a dock, I can go to the catalog that the Department of Fish and Game maintains publicly. I can look to determine whether or not that waterway is an anadromous fish habitat, and then I can proceed from there. And in this world that's imagined under ballot measure number one, there's a lot more uncertainty for Alaskans, and they do run a risk if they want to build a dock or they want to do those sort of small projects that are important to everyday Alaskans.
Mm-hmm. Any comeback, Emily?
Yeah, absolutely. So here's another kind of misconception about this is that the Anadromous Waters Catalog, it does remain in effect. Ballot Measure 1 does not get rid of the Anadromous Waters Catalog. It also allows Fish and Game to continue to sample and sample various streams and continue to add more waters to the Anadromous Waters Catalog. It also allows private citizens to continue to go through that process. In our population centers and the places where on the road system in particular, those water bodies have all been cataloged. You know, as a private property owner, whether or not you are on a salmon system or whether or not Fish and Game has already identified that water body as being excluded from the Anadromous Waters Catalog. It's all there, all of that data. What we're really talking about are the places that have not been well documented, that tend not to have a large population, but are targeted by big industry for development projects. Those are the places where we need the anadromous waters presumption so Fish and Game can immediately start their good work of making sure that when those projects are being developed at the very beginning that they can actually protect and use the law to protect those habitats.
Okay, we're going to come back and continue this discussion. We're going to take a one-minute break, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Today we are discussing ballot measure one, which Alaskans will be voting up or down on November 6th. And we have representatives from Stand for Salmon, the folks who put the initiative on the ballot, and Stand for Alaska, the folks in Alaska who are encouraging a no vote on ballot measure one. We've covered a lot of territory in the first two-thirds of our show. I'm going to ask now, what happens if this does pass? Sometimes I hear people discussing the fact that the language will be challenged immediately, or I also see when I look at the state's FAQ that there will be some regulations written by Fish and Game. So I want to talk about what if it does pass. And there's one thing I want to mention. One of the commentaries I read related to this made this point, and so maybe we can fold this in. Again, this was Frank Rue, and he said, if the initiative passes, the legislature has the ability to immediately clarify language in the initiative, if necessary, and in 2 years, the legislature can amend or even go as far as the repeal of the initiative. So let's talk about what happens if it passes. From the Stand for Alaska side, what are your concerns? From Stand for Salmon, what are your concerns? And what about this idea that it is not sort of, you know, a great big thunderbolt doesn't come down? I mean, it sounds like there's language can be modified by the legislature. The whole thing could be thrown out. So help me understand that. I want to make sure Alaskans know they're voting for something that may be malleable. So who would like to begin?
I can start. The Alaska Constitution allows citizens of Alaska to create law through ballot initiative. Oftentimes, that is done as a last resort when the state legislature has failed to act and has failed to act for a very long time on a very important issue that's important to the people of Alaska. That's essentially where ballot initiative often comes into play. This ballot initiative is extremely important to the state of Alaska and the future of our fisheries. That does not mean that the legislature doesn't get to be part of this process. The ballot initiative passes, it does go to the legislature, and like any law, the legislature can amend the law. They can amend provisions that, as it's being rolled out, as it's being applied, are unworkable or unmanageable. It can also strengthen provisions that they believe need even more strength in it. They can also take into account testimony from the public. They can take into account testimony from big industry. They can take into account testimony from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game about modifications they should make to the law. The great thing about this process is that it is very public. It's been public in the past through HB 199 and all the testimony that flowed in there. A lot of that testimony and those comments were incorporated into the initiative. And the initiative is a living document, just like any other law. And so the legislature does have the ability to do that. In addition, there will be a very public process around creating regulations through the Department of Fish and Game. That is a very public process where all interest groups are allowed to comment and help define and direct where those regulations go. And that is another opportunity. Simply because an initiative is voted on by the people doesn't mean that it's not a living document, that it's set in stone, that it can never be changed.
Okay, Clint, help us out. What's your take on that? I mean, that it is still a malleable document and that some of these concerns that you have raised might be mitigated by the legislature?
Well, I mean, it's ironic, and from my perspective, to say that the legislature has failed to act on something that, from Emily's perspective, is considered to be important. And I agree, it's important to protect our salmon habitat. I come from this from the perspective that the Department of Fish and Game and our state agencies are adequately protecting our salmon habitat. But to on one hand say that the legislature has failed to act, but then to say, well, they can fix it if it's not workable, it's ironic. What I am also concerned about, as I've said already, is that this can be challenged in court. And this is 8 pages, as you said during the break. There's a lot to hold in your head, and there's a lot in this. It's single spaced, 8 pages, and the courts are going to have to go through it one by one. And I've heard this law described as a lawyer's paradise because there are opportunities for lawyers to challenge this in court, and that's going to take time. It's going to take money, and that's going to be separate and distinct from what the legislature needs to do. There is not necessarily a feedback loop between what the courts are involved in and what the legislature is doing. under the initiative, it allows for, even for the minor permits, the ones that could affect everyday Alaskans, it allows anyone to ask for a reconsideration of a determination. And so that's another process that's in place that can slow down small projects, even everyday Alaskan projects. And it's not clear how the court's going to interpret those challenges of reconsideration.
Okay. I'm going to come back to you, Emily. You are also a lawyer, so you would have a perspective on language and maybe the concern that this could lead to many lawsuits. So help us. I imagine the Stand for Salmon folks have thought about this. So what's the perspective?
I think that the statement about litigation oftentimes is a scare tactic. It's plain and simple. It's a scare tactic. It's designed to scare people to think that they'll never be able to build a project, that they'll never be able to, do anything on their property. That's an absolute scare tactic. Every single permitting process, except for this one, allows for legal challenges in court. DNR's permitting process, DEC's permitting process, federal permitting processes, all of them allow for challenges in court. And yet people are still able to do the projects that they need to do. Small businesses are able to get the permits they need to get. The same will be true for this law as well. The idea that this is going to get caught up in court and that every single permit is going to get challenged is just frankly false, and it doesn't make any sense given what we know about other permitting processes and the ways that the agencies issue these permits. You don't challenge a whole lot of them.
Mm-hmm. Can you come back to that, Clint?
Yes. The concern about challenges to this is the presumption that the protection of the salmon habitat is the overriding primary determining factor over any other considerations, whether it be other appropriate uses of water, whether it be construction projects that are necessary for our infrastructure, projects that would improve or contribute to our economy. The way this initiative is set up is that the primary and only determining factor for fish habitat permits is the protection of salmon to the detriment of all other considerations.
And you come back to that, Emily.
Yeah, that's just simply false. I mean, this is a permitting process which contemplates that development will move forward. It opens the door specifically to development projects. What we're talking about here is actually putting some standards in place that actually defines what responsible development means in the state of Alaska. Oftentimes, that is a buzzword that is used by many, many people in big industry. And frankly, that needs to have a definition. What does that actually mean, especially when we're talking about projects that are being developed in and around salmon habitat? We need to be careful. We need to be careful about how we're pursuing and how we're proceeding. We do not want to end up paying millions, if not billions of dollars as a state trying to recover our salmon populations as they do in the lower 48, especially Washington, Oregon, and California. We don't want to have to be in that position. We need to be smart about how we're developing in and around salmon habitat, and we need to do it responsibly, and that is what the initiative sets up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I am going to, I think I've got it here. There are ads running, and what I saw this in the Nome Nugget. I've seen it in the Anchorage Daily News, and I know this is a radio show, but people can't see this ad. But I think if I talk about it, it says experts agree ocean problems are causing declining salmon runs, and it essentially says ballot measure one can't help that problem, I guess. So I would like both sides to discuss this a little bit and help voters know how to think about this. I'd start with you, Clint. It is a Stand for Alaska ad, and it does quote several biologists saying, hey, baby fish are coming out of our streams. Our streams are in great shape. Bad things are happening out in the ocean, and there's really nothing we can do about that. So help us with this.
So I'm not an ocean biologist. I'm not a fish biologist. I'm not even an environmental lawyer. But from my perspective, if we're going to have common ground in this debate, I don't know if there's an agreement or a consensus that our current salmon habitats are healthy or not. I mean, so that's the start point. I come from this from the perspective that they are healthy, and yet there are declining salmon runs, and there are other contributing factors that are contributing to that, whether it be overfishing, whether it be the commercial fishing industry, whether it be problems with our climate as a planet. But I come from this from the perspective that our salmon habitats are healthy, and the problems with the salmon runs are not being caused by our salmon habitat.
Okay. Emily, feedback on that.
Well, I do a lot of this work. This is kind of my area of specialty. I also go out and talk to people all around the state that care very deeply about our salmon populations, our communities that depend on them. For thousands of Alaskans, it is a way of life. It is salmon are directly tied to culture, and it is a huge economic driver in the state. People in Alaska know that are basically linked to these resources know that there are a number of things that are contributing to rises and falls and declines in salmon around the state. However, what we do know for certain is that we have to have two things to create sustainable fisheries in the state. One is good harvest management, and the second is excellent habitat management. We just simply don't have a lot of control over what's happening in the oceans, and it's really unfortunate. It's going to take a big federal effort in order to get that situation under control. What we do have control of, and one of the biggest things that we can do as Alaskans, is make sure that our inland habitat is protected and that our inland habitat is well managed. That is where we can offer safe harbor to those fish species that are facing certain challenges out in the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Moving on, another area that I hear lots of conflict about is on-site versus off-site mitigation. Maybe, Emily, I would start with you and say, what does the initiative say about mitigation? And then we'll go back and forth on discussing that. So go ahead.
The initiative creates a set of standards that create basically a mitigation sequence. This is what we talk about when we're creating standards to guide responsible development. It first says that we need to first, if at all possible, avoid impacts to fish habitat. Let's not take the easy way out all the time. Let's strive to engineer and design our projects in order to avoid impacts if at all possible. And this is where the DORG is open to development projects that do impact fish habitat. It also says if you can't avoid it, then we need to think about ways to minimize it. Again, oftentimes that's done through engineering and design. Maybe that means that instead of putting in a small culvert when you're building a road, you put in a fish passage culvert when you're building a road so that that stream is not... or that fish can access the upper reaches of that stream. That's what we're talking about. And finally, it asks the developer to restore the area and clean up your mess when you're finished with the project. When we talk about on-site versus off-site mitigation, the initiative bans off-site mitigation. The reason why it does that is in federal law and other state laws, off-site mitigation is absolutely abused. It allows for large companies to essentially get around the protective standards in the law and pay your way out of having to comply with the law. That's the reason why it bans offsite mitigation. We think that it's important for every entity that's doing work in fish habitat to play by the same rules and apply the same standards.
Okay. Clint, your perspective on that.
So I think I heard Emily say that the answer to your question is that offsite mitigation is banned. It's prohibited under the initiative. And that is a concern in that if you have a small salmon-bearing stream and there's a proposed project that would alter, divert, obstruct that waterway permanently, even perhaps due to whether it be a hydroelectric project, a mining project, or whatever the project is, regardless of the economic impact, the infrastructure benefits, or any other benefits to that community or to our state, there is no opportunity for that developer to engage in offsite mitigation that would offset the damage to that small stream. Even if there's a small number of anadromous fish that would be affected by it, there is nothing that a developer could do to mitigate that in another location. Even if that offsite mitigation may be overall better for the salmon habitat in that region.
Emily, any comeback to that? I'm in my head, I'm hearing some of the debates that I've tuned into about this. And on the Stanford salmon side, I have heard the mitigation has to be done in the same watershed or water area, and that's huge. On the other side of Stanford, Alaska, the concern that, well, you know, an airport might be trying to move wetlands away so that birds aren't, you know, around the airfield when it's landing, and this would prohibit that. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, well, I think, again, that's just some misinformation that's out there, quite frankly. There are many ways where fish and game can, through the initiative, comply with the language of the initiative and have some really good common sense mitigation outcomes. It does not prohibit any damage to salmon habitat. What it does do is says, basically, we really need to think about how we're designing these projects. The easiest design that a project proponent might put in front of you doesn't mean that we have to follow the easiest design. Sometimes we need to push back a little bit. Sometimes we need to say, listen, we support your project, but we need to make sure that X, Y, and Z, especially when we're talking about our fisheries, are protected. So we need you to do, we need to put in fish passage culverts. We need you to be careful about how you're designing your project in and around fisheries. We need to have you set this project back by 25 feet so that you're reducing your impact to fisheries. That's what we're talking about here with respect to offsite or onsite mitigation. The reason why it talks about offsite mitigation and bans it is projects like the Pebble Mine, when they were first starting to think about offsite mitigation and how they're going to mitigate the damage, the enormous damage they would do to the Bristol Bay system, is they were thinking about actually protecting an area down in California. That would be allowed under the current law. This would ban that operation. That shouldn't be something that we're even thinking about. We should be thinking strategically about how we reduce damages on site within the scope of the project, within the engineering of that project, rather than just saying, hey, go ahead and do this and we'll deal with the repercussions afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another criticism I have heard of the initiative is that it has been brought forward to stop big projects, and I've heard the debate that no, it is not, but I'd like to engage in it here a little bit, just for the benefit of voters. And I know we've talked about, small projects, ordinary Alaskans, docks on their riverfront property, that sort of thing. Why would people be suggesting that this is aimed at stopping another Pebble? Or I've even heard people suggest that the Alaska LNG project couldn't go forward. So, it gets at this idea of stopping development. And so maybe I'm going to start with you, Clint. That fear that, gee, it's going to slow everything down. We won't be able to build the projects we need to build. Why are you so afraid? Why is Stand for Alaska so afraid of that? And then we'll go to Emily and let her respond.
So the concern, my answer would be twofold. First, there can be no dispute in this debate that Alaska's economy is not in a good place. We've been on a downward spiral in the last number of years. Alaska's been rated as the 50th place out of 50 states to do business in the United States. To those that support the initiative, my question would be, what message are you telling industry, whether it be in Alaska or outside of Alaska, about the willingness of Alaska as a state to do business with folks that want to develop natural resources? And then with regard to, and that would be regarding new projects, but for our existing projects, the most important being TAPS, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, there are permits that they need to obtain and they need to renew. And while there is, we haven't talked about the grandfather clause that the initiative folks have mentioned, but those permits do need to be renewed. And there's great concern that they won't be able to get renewed permits. And even if they can get them, they're going to be more time consuming and more expensive.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have heard some debate about that. Oh my gosh. Oh, one sentence, Emily, I'm sorry. And then I have to sign off. Just one.
I think this is a very important and this is a big moment for the state of Alaska. I hope everybody does go to our website, reads up the initiative, learns about it, and knows that this is about protecting our fisheries for the future of Alaska. Vote yes.
Okay. Thanks to Emily Anderson and Clint Campion for coming on and discussing Ballot Measure 1. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. And thanks, Dave Waldron, as our audio engineer. I'm Kathleen McCoy. Thanks for joining us today on Hometown Alaska.
Home. Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.